And let me be very clear, it's not very often that someone from our side, a true vaccine skeptic that has some knowledge of the data, gets to ask a direct question of the people who are mandating this.
Hi everyone, this is Veronika Kirilenko of the New American Magazine. Earlier this month, the 23rd World Vaccine Congress took place in Washington, D.C. Billed as the most important vaccine event of the year, it gathered more than 3,100 high-profile attendees from the pharma and biotech industries, regulatory bodies, and vaccine developers for the United States military. What's their vision like on hot public health matters and vaccination policies? Today, I'm delighted to speak with Dr. Madhava Sethi, who attended the conference. Dr. Sethi is a senior science editor for The Defender, a board-certified anesthesiologist, and the author of the book Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View. Dr. Sethi, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Veronica. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Doctor, please tell us about the conference. Was it indeed the most important vaccine event of the year? And what was on the agenda?
Well, judging from the presentations and the size of the venue, I would say if it wasn't the most important, it was definitely one of the most important gatherings. It was a real honor for me to go. I want to first of all, thank Children's Health Defense for funding my attendance there, as well as another physician, my colleague, Dr. Liz Mumper, who's a pediatrician in Virginia, actually. And so we went down there. And what was your other question? Was it as big as it?
What was the agenda of the meeting? What topics were discussed?
Well, the agenda, as they describe it, is how cutting-edge research integrates with pharma and biotech and regulatory agencies in the government and academia. So it was attended by a great number of people, over 3,000. I believe it was the most attended vaccine congress that they've ever put on. And so there was a lot of very important people there in the industry and in the regulatory agencies from across the world.
Doctor, why did you decide to go into the belly of the beast, to use your own terms?
Someone had to. let's be very clear here. We have diverged in our groupings. There are large divides between the vaccine hesitant and cautionary and the vaccine proponents. And this was an opportunity that I really was excited to take. And, quite frankly, there are other people who are probably more qualified than I to could have attended, but they're generally more prominent with, names and recognizable faces. So my anonymity, I think, was an asset.
And how did you use it?
Well, how did I use my anonymity, you mean?
And this opportunity in general.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The opportunity, well, it started off as a fact-finding mission just to see what they were talking about, what was important to that industry. And then very quickly, I realized that there were some openings that could be utilized to start conversations, especially in open panel discussions where questions were taken from the floor. And I had an opportunity to ask more or less the same question over and over again. And I think it would be very important here to tell your audience that they're not as monolithic in their position about the vaccine safety and efficacy. I think there's significant doubt about the certainty that they have, and it was never expressed necessarily by the presenters or the moderators, but in the audience, every time I would ask a question, people around me would say, that's a really good question. And why didn't they answer the question? And I was approached by people afterwards in the hallways who felt like they had to acknowledge their appreciation of the my critique of what was going on. And my colleague, Dr. Mumper, had the same experience. So the point here is that the people in the audience knew that this absolute certainty of the product was to be questioned and was unjustified to varying degrees.
Well, but let's talk about the speakers. They were really distinguished people. I understand the opening panel discussion was dedicated to the topic of COVID vaccines. Have you witnessed a proverbial scientific consensus among the panelists that these vaccines are life-saving, or were there scientists who disputed the narrative?
No, there was no disputation of the narrative from the panel speakers. And I would say that the opening plenary session that was hosted by Dr. Gregory Poland, who was the director of vaccine research at the Mayo Clinic, basically said it all right up front in the beginning, touting the enormous advantage of the COVID-19 vaccinations and protecting people. He stated, without really any substantiating evidence, that they have saved millions of lives. And that the greatest challenge that they have right now is, in fact, vaccine hesitancy, which was the thread that I could pull on for the rest of the next 3 days. If that is truly what their concern is, and they're looking for suggestions, you know, my suggestion over and over again was, why don't you bring on the experts who disagree with you and have an open discussion and let the public decide? You know, that was always my attack. And it was never acknowledged or answered effectively. But more or less, but moreover, in that opening session was also Peter Marks, who is the head of CBER, which is the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research at the FDA, who also sits on the FDA's VRBPAC. And he said some very startling things right from the opening. The first was, he's given up on a sterilizing COVID-19 vaccine. Sterilizing mean, you know, something that prevents transmission and infection. He says that's an unattainable goal, right? So basically, these products are meant, in his opinion, just to prevent symptoms, which in fact is basically what a medical therapy does. It's not a preventive measure. It's, you know, more of a therapeutic thing. And now we're crossing the line between vaccines and medicines. And, you know, as we all know, there's a completely different standards for liability with vaccines as compared to medicines. So there's a lot of melding of things going on that is in favor of less regulation when it comes down to vaccines. He also said something very startling, which was that he's through arguing with people who believe that these vaccines are not safe, which I think is a remarkable statement coming from someone who's supposed to be leading the effort to regulate these things. It sounds to me like his mind is closed around the possibility that these things may have untoward effects. So that was disquieting, to say the least.
And the professor whom you mentioned with the Mayo Clinic, isn't he vaccine injured himself?
Yeah, that's what was the most startling. You know, we at The Defender wrote a piece about his, he divulged the fact that he suffered from tinnitus after receiving a second mRNA vaccine in February of 2021. I'm sorry, 2022. And he made it publicly known that it was caused by the vaccine. And I was under the impression that given his unmitigated support of these products, that he had recovered. But when I spoke to him at the end of the conference, 4 days later, he told me personally that it was still debilitating. So that makes his, you know, commentary in the beginning hypocritical, to say the least.
This is weird. So how do these people plan to build vaccine confidence? What are their strategies?
Well, it was best described in a roundtable discussion I had, and their strategy is to use targeted messaging for people who have certain proclivities in the way they think, who have been exposed to misinformation to, you know, varying degrees. And I would summarize by saying that their approach would be essentially to almost pathologize the vaccine hesitant as having some sort of cognitive dysfunction or biases that lead them away from what is the obvious solution, which is to get vaccinated. So that is their approach. You know, it's always about how do we fix the way these people are thinking rather than actually addressing what their concerns are, right?
Yes, because the main driving factor behind people's unwillingness to get a vaccine is actually safety concerns. One of the panel discussions was specifically dedicated to vaccine safety, and one of the subtopics was pharmacovigilance tools or tools for detecting and monitoring safety signals. Has anyone addressed the unusual dynamics in virus starting in 2021? Dynamics and, you know, the increase of adverse effects associated with COVID vaccines.
The answer to that is no. That was never brought up. Like VAERS, the UK's yellow card, all of the data coming from there was never acknowledged as being real. And the one discussion that I entered where people were talking about vaccine adverse events, I couldn't bear it, honestly. I was sitting there for 20 minutes and the presenter was basically talking about the databases that she had mined around vaccine adverse events in Africa, and over said, well, we can't rely on this and we can't rely on this and we can't rely on that. And this has not been confirmed. And basically, you know, laying down the idea that none of these things really can be confirmed. So there's too much uncertainty about the adverse events, but nonetheless, the efficacy is absolutely certain. You know, it was that kind of, difference in opinion of looking at data that pervaded the entire discussion.
Yeah, and I see that on the website of the event that another panel on vaccine safety was about risk-benefit assessment, and that's another sticking point, right? How can we make sure the vaccines are safe when the regulators are evidently captured? And the same is true for major academic institutions and their medical journals. And institutional mistrust is one of the major causes of vaccine hesitancy. Has it been brought up during the sessions or perhaps privately?
Well, it's very clear that they see that institutional mistrust is a major problem. But their solution is, in my opinion, anemic. Because in order to actually address mistrust, you would have to, you know, listen to the other side. This is what I keep saying over and over again. It's like, you know, look, you've convinced all of the people with your gift cards to Target and your inability to travel without a vaccine. Those people have you've converted, right? And now you're sitting with a very startling statistic, which is only 15% of people have taken the bivalent booster, where we have, you know, 80% in this country have taken at least one shot of the primary series. So there has been an enormous deflation in interest in the vaccine. So who is left, right? You know, it's not the people who want the Krispy Kreme donuts anymore. These are people who are looking at both sides and who have, spokespersons who are qualified to speak on this. And that's who they're listening to. But for someone who does not know how to examine data for themselves, all they see are two groups that are mirror images of each other. Both are saying that the other side is gullible, that the other side is listening to misinformation, and that the other side is causing untold harm from their position. Both sides look exactly the same to someone who does not look at the data, right? But only one side is asking for a discussion, mm-hmm. and the other side is asking for censorship. How on earth are you going to convert those people by continuing to censor their side? Doesn't it make sense that we should bring on the, you know, Pierre Corys and Paul Merricks and Meryl Nasses and Tess Laurie, who, you know, I know that you had on recently? You know, these are incredible, incredibly credentialed physicians and scientists that are not being given a seat at the table. Why not bring them on?
Doctor, how do you explain this very unscientific, intolerant worldview of cream of the crop in vaccine affairs? Where does this self-destructing, really, approach to communication and debate come from?
That's a really good question. I mean, that is, you know, sort of the psychosis of that side. And I would suggest that it is being transmitted by the people at the very top. As you know, it's interesting that Gregory Poland is also a pastor, because his entire delivery was almost, you know, as if we're in a house of worship, talking about, you know, the tenets that we believe on. Let's get it very clear here. They're safe. They save millions of people. And the people who don't subscribe are heretics, in other words. I mean, it was almost delivered in that way. And it was evident in the closing sessions as well. So there is no explanation, honestly, for why they're unable to see this happening. And therefore, we have to run with the hypothesis that they're being manipulated on the inside, just like people in the public are being manipulated with this messaging.
Mm-hmm. So, Doctor, but there are, I see huge problems with this. What are the implications for public health of this lack of debate?
Wow, that's another big question. the implications are, well, I think the implications have become, you know, actual reality. People are not taking the vaccine. They don't, you know, a very interesting person came up who was funded by Merck to do this research. Like, he's a behavioral scientist. His name is Christopher Graves. And if your audience is interested in looking him up, he is quite... quite the man. You know, he's got a lifetime membership to the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, part of the WF. He's been in media for decades, and he's kind of the brains behind shaping the narrative towards, like, how do we convince people to get the vaccine from a behavioral science perspective. And when I asked him directly, you know, have you, you know, How would you address the person, a physician, who looks at the data and can clearly see that all-cause mortality was higher in the vaccine group in the original Pfizer trial? That should be a, you know, a hard stop. You know, I'm not saying no vaccine, but let's make a better vaccine. Like, that's a very reasonable position. What do you think about that? And he just smiled at me and he said, look, I haven't looked at the data. I'm just trying to, that's not my job. My job is to try to convince people to get vaccinated. And, you know, it's puzzling. And it wasn't lost on the audience. As I said before, people were very appreciative of these kinds of direct questions. And let me be very clear, it's not very often that someone from our side, a true vaccine skeptic that has some knowledge of the data, gets to ask a direct question of the people who are, you know, mandating this or directing the narrative. And the answers were very, very telling. And, like, I have several examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Would you care to provide us with any?
Yeah. Well, you know, for example, Ofer Levy, who also sits on the FDA's VRBPAC, was talking about the markers for vaccine efficacy. And his own panel at the FDA has made it clear a year ago that antibody responses are not a surrogate for protection. Mm-hmm. It's no good, right? But at the same time, that's what they're using to validate the efficacy of the bivalent booster. That's also what they use to validate the efficacy of the pediatric formulation back in 2021. So they're caught in a double standard. And that's what I was calling him out on. And I said, look, you know, and this is, again, it's sort of a matter of, like, how do you ask the question without appearing to be combative? And I said, look, the people that you're trying to convince, they don't want to get the vaccine because you have not demonstrated an outcome. Like, has it protected against infection or hospitalization in your trials? No, they haven't. So why not do a trial where you have enough people that you can prove efficacy? And he said, well, we at the FDA VRBPAC, we cannot tell the vaccine industry what kind of study to do. We have to either say yay, nay, or abstain. And then one of his colleagues said, well, look, you can't do a trial big enough because the population is non-naive, meaning it's already been, people have been exposed to the vaccine and they've been exposed to COVID. The study would have to be too large because the signal is so small. And then when I said, if the signal is so small, why are you shoving it down their throats? In other words, you know, if the benefit is tiny, what's the big deal? And that's when the moderator jumps in and says, whoa, we got to, you know, move on to another question. And, you know, this is typified by other kinds of discussions I had with people.
Yeah, and it relates to my final question. Is open dialogue with this camp still possible with the side? Well, they are clearly unwilling to engage in a civil debate. They view any critics as a threat or idiots, no matter how competent and credentials. And more importantly, Doctor, how do we speak with them if they seem to have no desire to admit their failures, if not crimes, of the past 3 years?
Well, I think the lesson here is not to try and convince the person with the microphone that they're wrong.
Okay.
The goal here is to convince all the people in the room that are listening that, oh my God, the guy with the microphone doesn't know what he's talking about.
Okay.
And that's something that we have to really understand here as we engage with our fellow human beings, is if you happen to have an opportunity to speak to someone who disagrees with you, who is a vaccine proponent, We have to understand that you're not going to convince that person, but you convince all the other people who are, you know, silently watching this exchange happen. And when you can present yourself in a way that is cogent and coherent and open to debate, and they are not, that's where you can, you know, that's where the traction is. And, you know, if I were to say anything in terms of a takeaway here, we, you know, the highest court in the land is the court of public opinion. Once we get the public to doubt it enough and challenge the narrative to an extent where they bring it up with their own PCPs, their primary care providers, that's the leverage point. Because once you get doctors to start challenging the CDC's edicts, then you can have a true transformation of public opinion. Of policy, and that should be our goal. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to attacking the Walensky's and Fauci's, we have to talk our fellow human beings into a place of, of reasonableness, you know, and ask and demand for the kinds of studies that are required to demonstrate safety. And they can't.
They cannot. Dr. Seti, I would like to thank you so much for your time today. Please tell us what's the best way to follow you and your work.
Well, thank you again for having me on. I would like it if people would go to my Substack. It's called An Insult to Intuition, where this particular article has been published. Of course, you know, more eyes on children's health events, the better. And please, you know, allow Bobby Kennedy to speak, and at least allow him to present his position on a national stage. That would be very, very helpful in this battle.
That was Dr. Madhava Seti, everyone. Thank you so much for watching. I'm Veronica Kirilenko of The New American Magazine.